In our previous teaching on this Irreligious Jesus series, I talked about the radical notion of forgiveness that Jesus modeled in every aspect of his life, a forgiveness that preceded everything for everyone. But one question was outstanding. What does that mean for me? Does how Jesus forgives change how I should forgive others? Well, the answer to that question is yes. But to understand that, I'm going to have to tell you two stories and a joke. But to understand them, we're going to have to say something about Jesus real quick. As we've said before, Jesus was a rabbi. And we translate this as teacher. But if you're now imagining your professor stood at the front of your classroom covered in chalk, leading you through today's version of death by PowerPoint slides, then you're not imagining a first century rabbi. Rabbis were eccentric characters, charismatic people. They taught indoors, outdoors, anywhere there was opportunity. The whole world was their lesson plan. They taught abstractly, constantly wanting their students to be alert to a lesson in the moment, but also for them to be aware that not everything in the world would agree with their worldview, theology, and perspective. So they taught to help their students understand this. They would test them on the spot. They would offer situational conundrums for them to solve. They told parables that were shocking and stories that were perturbing, and they loved irony and jokes. They would ask questions that demanded the wrong answer. They would misquote scripture to see if their students could spot it. They might even tell a parable and see if their students could figure out how to apply it. But when we come to read Jesus, we often see professor and not rabbi, which I think causes us to ignore the power of some of his parables and often completely miss his jokes altogether. And when it comes to forgiveness, this is pretty catastrophic. Which brings us to Matthew chapter 18. So grab a Bible or your Bible app and let's dive into this. In verse 12 and 13 of chapter 18, Jesus asks this. What do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go look for the one that wandered off? And if he finds it, truly I tell you, he is happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. Now, I realize that right now you're thinking I maybe slightly oversold this. I set up this premise of a rabbinic teaching being charismatic and shocking and testing, and then I told the parable of the lost sheep. And the premise of this parable is, well, it's quite simple, isn't it? There's a little sheep and it gets lost, and the good shepherd, he goes to find it. But we also know that this story is a little backward, because in truth, the premise doesn't work. If you lose one sheep and leave 99 on the hills to go look for it, how many sheep do you now have? Yep, that's right. You have one sheep. And 99 other people have shepherd's pie. So the economics of this story don't work. Jesus tells the story as if it's normal, but it really isn't. And analyzing the story isn't overly helpful either. I mean, did the sheep deserve to get lost? Well, that's the dumbest question ever. It's a sheep. You know, well, was it a criminal? Was it high? Did it evade taxes? Was it a good father? It's a sheep. The only relevant data in the story is that the sheep is lost and that there is a good shepherd who is inordinately, surprisingly, and almost nonsensically drawn to sheep that get lost. However, I think that there's one implicit question that is important about this famous little story. And here it is. Can you remember it? Like, I don't mean recite the two verses. I mean, does it get down into your heart? Can you remember it like that? Does the story of this relentless shepherd shape the way that you think and behave? Can you remember it? Like, I think that's why Jesus tells the story right here at this point of Matthew chapter 18. Because immediately after the story of this lost sheep, Jesus offers the following advice on forgiveness to his disciples. In verses 15 and 17, he says this, "If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault, just between the two of you. If they listen to you, you have won them over. But if they will not listen, take one or two others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If they still refuse to listen, tell it to the church. And if they refuse to listen even to the church, treat them as you would a pagan or a tax collector. Now, this text here has been Christianity's go-to passage for the past 2,000 years when the question of forgiveness has come up. It's where the idea of excommunication comes from. And let's be honest, we like this passage. It gives us clear rules and boundaries. It tells us when to get the gun and drive that wayward sheep off the farm. But it's also fully fledged religiosity. If you want to be in, it tells you what to do. And if you are in, it gives you a three strikes process to deal with how to get people out. And the history of Christianity suggests that we quite like this type of Jesus. Maybe we even prefer him. Like, here's the line, and then once you cross it, we're treating you like a pagan. Which is unfortunate for us, because I think that this is one of the places where Jesus is joking. I'm convinced that this is Jesus throwing down a test to his disciples. And I don't think I'm being sacrilegious here, but I think this is the only way to make sense of what's happening in this passage. Like, there was a lost sheep, remember? But I don't remember anything about three strikes. Do you? Now, Jesus wanted his disciples to get the answer right, so he embedded a pretty massive clue in the three strikes test. I wonder if you saw it. After the third strike, Jesus says, you must treat the person like a pagan or a tax collector, which leads us to ask this new question. How did Jesus treat tax collectors and pagans? Well, this is awkward because he had supper with them. He defended them. He cared for them. He forgave them. He invited them to follow him. He died for them. Don't forget, you're reading Matthew's gospel, and Matthew was a tax collector. So this passage, on its own, out of context, is graceless, religious, and rule-driven, and totally not how Jesus works. Now, for some of us, that might seem a surprise to suggest that Jesus is joking or being ironic or playful even in the Bible, in a biblical text. And I wonder if that's because we imagine him just a little too monochrome and boring, not the revolutionary table turner that he was. So come with me for a little bit more, and let me show you some more in Matthew chapter 18. Because after Jesus has said this three strikes piece, Peter comes to him. And Peter obviously thinks that Jesus was being ironic. Peter detects that there's a test or a game afoot. And we know this because look at what Peter asks in verse 21. He says, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times? Do you see what Peter does? Like, he clearly thinks that Jesus' three strikes test, it's a little bit stingy. So he offers a bigger number, and he wants to appear magnanimous. So he says seven. Seven is the Jewish number of holiness and completion. It's the idea of perfection. Hasn't Peter done well? He's more than doubled Jesus' test. To which Jesus replies, I tell you, not seven times, but 70 times seven. 70 times 7 is like an ancient Jewish way of saying, you know, jam all the numbers on your calculator until the error sign appears. Like, it's like perfection multiplied by completion. Peter's adjustments reveal that he had forgotten the simple story of the lost sheep, in which we learn that math and numbers are not a feature of this kingdom, so they won't be a feature of forgiveness either. Okay, so let's just review Jesus' setup quickly. Jesus comes to his disciples, and he says to them, okay, so there's a shepherd who pursues lost sheep relentlessly. Relentlessly, say the disciples? Okay, says Jesus, let's try a rule rather than a story, because you guys seem to like rules. A shepherd gives his dumb sheep three chances to be found, and then he gives up on it. To which the disciples say, well, that seems a little bit harsh, Jesus. Maybe we should give them seven chances. To which Jesus says, after what I imagine to be like a really long pause and an eye roll, Jesus says, what about 490 times? What about infinity times infinity? What about relentlessly? And there's the shock. In this passage, there's a religious rule and an irreligious, almost nonsensical story. But it turns out that the rule is a joke, and it's the story that Jesus wants us to follow. Because Peter's like all of us, and he's a little slow to really catch this. So Jesus offers another parable in verse 21, and this time he begins it explicitly. In 18 and verse 21, he says, "The kingdom of heaven is like," which is Jesus' way of saying, pay attention here. This has something to do with how I think we should all live. "The kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. As he began the settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. And since he was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. At this, the servant fell on his knees before him. 'Be patient with me.'" And the Greek word here is quite literally, "have a massive heart. Be massive-hearted with me," he begs, "and I'll pay back everything." The servant's master took pity on him, canceled the debt, and let him go. But when that servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. He grabbed him and began to choke him. "Pay back what you owe me," he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and begged him. And notice what he says. "Be patient, be big, massive-hearted with me, and I will pay it back." But he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could repay the debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged and went and told their master everything that had happened. And then the master called the servant in. "You wicked servant," he said. "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. And then Jesus ends like this. He said, "This is how my heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from your heart." Now, allow yourself just to be drawn into this story for a moment. Like, this is a little closer to home than a lost sheep. A man is in crippling debt. And before you start to try and work out what 10,000 bags of gold is worth, don't. Because this is essentially a parabolic way of saying, like, $1 trillion, like Gates or Bezos levels of money that essentially nobody could pay back. And yet, this ruler forgives him this debt, like, unbelievably. And even in a made-up story, it's kind of hard to accept a plot like this. But this is what grace-driven forgiveness looks like. As we said in our previous teaching, like, forgiveness, it comes free, gratis, undeserved, and unearned. In Jesus, it's just given to us. And the story started by saying that the king wanted to settle his accounts, but you didn't expect it to mean this. Like, we expected law, but we got relentless grace. Our religiosity assumes that settle debts means pay back. And maybe, just maybe, our religiosity wants settle debts to mean pay back. And at that moment, we see the deep-rooted appeal of religiosity. Because even when faced with surprising grace, we still default to religious rules. It's as if there's something in us that demands that everything be earned and achieved and gained on merit. And yet, here's the fascinating sociological twist in the story. That even when faced with radical grace, the impossible forgiven, this servant completely and utterly misses it. Like, we know this because he walks out and begins to choke someone who owes him, well, what is a fraction of what he's just had forgiven? Now, at this point, like, you could say, well, the guy owed him, didn't pay it back, and he broke the rules, so he deserved to be half choked to death. Like, you could say that, but there's probably something wrong with you if you do. Why? Because we've read the first part of the parable. Can this guy not join the dots? And in truth, the more common response when reading this parable is that it's ridiculous. We struggle to believe that this is even plausible. Like, would anyone really be released from trillions of dollars of debt and slavery and then go out and throttle the breath out of someone for a couple of bucks? The answer? Yeah. And we know this because we see it all the time in the world. We know this because the unforgiving servant is me and you and everyone else in the world. He is all of us. Because we're so wired for rules and regulations and religiosity that even when we encounter radical, surprising grace, we still want to talk about what is owed and what we deserve. We do this in our businesses, our relationships, our friendships, with our wives, our husbands, our parents, our children. We insist on framing our worldview according to deserving, to merit, and to what is earned. If you don't believe me, ask this question. When frustrated with a family member or a friend, have you ever framed a sentence in a way that says something like, "After all I've done for them"? What is it about us that makes us think that getting even will solve anything? If you get to settle your account with someone, are you going to feel better? If someone gives you back what they owe or what you deserve, are things going to go back to normal now? Like, every single one of us has been hurt by someone. Everyone. Some of those hurts are worse than others. Some people's hurt is so horrific that you almost can't bear to listen to it. But some of my friends tell me that what can happen after a while of holding on to that horrendous hurt and waiting for the chance to get even, what happens is that hurt becomes part of you and it starts to shape you. Anger, rage, bitterness. Like, maybe you would love to move on. Maybe all it takes is seeing something or hearing something and you're triggered. You find yourself caught up in that vortex of emotions and end up back at the start plotting how you're going to get even. Forgiveness is the mechanism of grace that sets you free from that. Can you imagine what it would be like to be able to see that person or drive past that place and have those memories and not feel all of those things? Like, wouldn't that feel like you were alive again? To not have your life or significant parts of it be defined by what someone else did to you? In Romans chapter 12, Paul says we've basically got two choices. We can sort it out ourselves. We can get what we're owed. We can get even. We can take revenge. Or we can leave it up to God. And forgiveness is a way of saying, "God, I trust you with this, and it's too much for me to carry." Forgiveness is a way of saying, "I just don't want to keep score anymore." And this doesn't mean that you run back to the person who hurt you or act as if nothing ever happened. Forgiveness is saying, "I'm just not trying to get even anymore." You're not simply releasing them. You're allowing yourself to be set free too. Because forgiveness is about us. And so we need to learn, quicker than the servant did, that the only barrier to the forgiven life is the refusal to live in that forgiveness. Like, Jesus' forgiveness and grace is designed to flow through us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says that Christ reconciled us and then asked us to be reconciling. So if we're forgiven, we forgive. When we forgive someone, we're essentially giving to them what God has given to us. Martin Luther King said that without the power to forgive, we're devoid of the power to love. And so there's a story of a lost sheep and a forgiven but unforgiving servant. And we are the servant in the story, but Jesus invites us to be the king. We are the sheep, but we have all the resources to be the shepherd. So you can choose, as Christians have done for many, many years, to take Jesus' joke seriously and ignore the parables. You can live with an accounting book and know who owes what and who deserves what. Or you can live life submersed in the forgiven life, where you know that by canceling the debts of others, you're actually setting yourself free. It's not going to be easy. It might take a long time. But it probably starts by making that decision today. So may you live out the truth of Jesus' great prayer that asks, "Forgive us as we forgive others." May you find freedom in giving forgiveness away to others. May you resist the temptation to keep hold of those accounts. And instead, may you let the radical, relentless, irreligious grace of Jesus pursue you, find you, and flow through you so that you may know that grace in you. And may His grace and peace be with you.